This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother stone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday never come.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is Race and Fraud, The Races of Mankind, Part 2. We're going to continue to discuss a pamphlet put out by Ruth Benedict and Gene Weltfish by the title The Races of Mankind. And I'll pick up where I left off last time with a section titled Blood the Same. For ages, men have spoken of blood relations as if different peoples had different blood. Some people have shouted that if we got into our veins the blood of someone with a different head shape, eye color, hair texture, or skin color, we would get some of that person's physical and mental characteristics. Modern science has revealed this to be pure superstition. All human blood is the same, whether it is the blood of an Eskimo or a Frenchman or of the purest German Aryan or an African pygmy, except for one medically important difference. This medical difference was discovered when doctors first began to use blood transfusion in order to save life. In early attempts at transfusion, it was discovered that agglutination or clumping together of the red blood cells sometimes occurred and caused death. Gradually, investigators learned that there are four blood types of blood called O, A, B, and AB, and that although blood typed O can be mixed successfully with the other three, none of these can be mixed with one another without clumping. These four blood types are inherited by each child from its forebears. But whites, Negroes, Mongols, and all races of man have all these blood types. The color of their skin does not tell at all which blood type they have. You and an Australian bushman may have the same blood type. I'll start by pointing out that pure superstition, calling this idea that the mixing of blood would transfer physical and mental characteristics as pure superstition. Superstition is an exaggeration, at the very least. It's an unsympathetic description of what was blood as a metaphor for inheritance, which was actually a reasonable, intuitive understanding of the mechanics of inheritance. If these anthropologists wanted to actually promote an understanding that was based on science, they could have cited August Weismann's germ plasm theory and the Weismann barrier, which was known to scientists since around the turn of the century, the previous century, around 1900. And this idea of the germ plasm theory is that inheritance only takes place by means of the egg and sperm cells. It's not the blood, actually, but it is the egg and the sperm. And the idea that other cells of the body, the somatic cells, do not function as agents of heredity. This was well known to science, and they could have used that as an explanation. A further scientific inquiry into this matter of heritability eventually revealed that it was genetics, and then ultimately beyond that, that it was DNA, this biochemical, this complicated biochemical, that was the actual mechanism of heritability. And some of this inquiry was done by the German scientists, including two that we've talked about before, Alfred Plowitz and Fritz Lenz. The blood intuition was valid in the sense that head shape and other heritable traits are indeed encoded within a person's body. And although they were mistaken, maybe the idea was mistaken that it was blood rather than DNA, if you could change your DNA, then the expression of those traits that are based on DNA would also change. So it's not a completely wild idea. And a more realistic example is what happens when you mix yourself with someone else and you produce children. That's what happens with heritability. And that, too, was well understood even before the turn of the century by scientists. What they're trying to do here, another element of their argument, is to minimize this one medically important difference, you know, saying that it's basically just one little difference, but it's not a little difference. It's a big difference, this difference in blood. And it's evidence of the heritability of unseen physical traits as well as visible physical traits. And what's really key here is this trick that they play, that of glossing over or trying to ignore the fact that it's the distribution of traits among races that make the races distinctive, that distinguish race. And a modern day reference for this is RedCrossBlood.org, which just one little thing from their site says different ethnic and racial groups have different frequency of the main blood types in their populations. That states it pretty plainly. That's the best that science today, and I suspect that even in 1943, this was understood, that it was a different frequency of these main blood types. Exactly what Benedict and Weltfish tried to gloss over. There are also, since World War II, many less common, lesser known blood subtypes that are unique, absolutely unique to certain ethnic groups have been uncovered. And just some quick facts about blood typing. The Rh factor was discovered in 1939 or so. And Rh negative is almost entirely a white trait. It's only found amongst whites. It's highest in the Basques at 20 to 35% of the Basque population. It's at around 15% for among Europeans in general, but it's near 0% in almost everyone else. Another fact about blood type is that Amerindians and Australoids are nearly 100% blood type O, and that would be O positive since they're not negative. So the chances are, if you're a European, there's a really good chance that you have some combination of A or B or Rh negative blood. And in that case, the blood of an Australian bushman is almost certainly incompatible with yours. That's what the probabilities, the scientific objective view, actually is of blood type. The fact is that the best donor for blood or organs is one who is most biologically chemical, most biochemically compatible with you. And this is most likely a close relative. And the closer related they are to you, the more likely they are to be compatible. The farther away genetically they are from you, the less likely they are to be compatible. That's the reality. That's the scientific reality. Beyond that, having more people like yourself around yourself increases the likelihood of blood or organ compatibility, and diversity in race mixing actually reduces it. So what they're arguing in favor of is actually making that aspect of life worse. So back to the races of mankind, it continues in the next section titled Color. Finally, let us take skin color, the most noticeable of the differences between peoples. Few traits have been used as widely to classify people. We all talk about black, white, and yellow races of man. Recently, scientists found that skin color is determined by two special chemicals. One of these, keratin, gives a yellow tinge. The other, melanin, contributes the brown. People of browner complexion simply have more melanin in their skin. People of yellowish color, more keratin. It is not an all-or-nothing difference. It is a difference in proportion. Your skin color is due to the amount of these chemicals present in the skin. So here again we see that they're calling attention to this difference in proportion as if that somehow negates the overall differences. And this is a recurring theme throughout not only this pamphlet but anti-racist arguments. The fact that the visible difference is triggered by an underlying chemical difference, which is ultimately a reflection of an underlying biological genetic difference, doesn't change the fact that it's a heritable difference. It's a racial difference. It's actually evidence in favor of race, not against race. The next section they title, How Are Races Classified? The three primary races of the world have their strongest developments in areas A, B, and C on the map on page 9. In these parts of the world, most of the inhabitants not only have the same skin color, but the same hair texture and noses. A is the race of the Caucasian race. A is the area of the Caucasian race. B, of the Mongoloid race. C, of the Negroid race. The Caucasian race inhabits Europe and a great part of the Near East and India. It is subdivided in broad bands that run east and west. Nordics, fair-skinned, blue-eyed, tall, and long-headed, are the most common in the north. Alpines, in between skin color, often stocky, broad-headed, in the middle. Mediterraneans, slenderer, often darker than alpines, long-headed, in the south. The distribution of racial subtypes is just about the same in Germany and in France. Both are mostly alpine, and both have Nordics in their northern districts. Racially, France and Germany are made up of the same stocks in just about equal proportions. American Indians are Mongoloid, though they differ physically both among themselves and from the Mongols of China. The natives of Australia are sometimes called a fourth primary race. A few things about this. In the map that they provide, they put little circles around the area A, which is centered on Sweden, B is centered on China, and C is centered on the Congo. And again, they're minimizing the difference. They're painting the majority of the map of the world as one gray color, identical color. And only these three smaller areas are labeled differently. And they're minimizing the geographic extent of the areas that they're labeling white, black, and yellow. They're also glossing over the different shades. They do that by labeling everything else this one monotonic gray, but also in the areas where they label as one particular color, they're glossing over the differences there in shades. And this is a willful blindness. It's interesting to contrast this with the illustrator Ad Reinhardt's later work, those black paintings I mentioned the last time. And this was art, and the art of it was an appreciation of the significance of subtle, near imperceptible differences in the shades of black that he used. So, and you know, they're perfectly, these people are perfectly capable of appreciating little subtle differences, except when it's not convenient for their agenda, for their argument. This portion of the pamphlet presents in pretty clear general terms an understanding of race that was what the contemporary, that the race scientists of the time, and even the Nordicists of the time, held. And it does it without sneering at it, without mocking it, without ridiculing it, without even arguing against it. It could have been written by a proponent of race, even by a proponent of eugenics or racial hygiene. It includes a nod to racial subtypes, even within Europe, the Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean. And it includes an acknowledgement of the difference of opinion over the number of major races. But they don't use any of these arguments against the idea of race. They instead state them to support their own agenda, their own argument, and that is an anti-racist agenda. And the very next section is an indication of what it is that they are trying to argue. And that is, the next section is titled, "There is no Jewish race." And they put quotes around race. "Aryans, Jews, Italians are not races. Aryans are people who speak Indo-European, Aryan languages. Hitler used the term in many ways, sometimes for blonde Europeans, including the Scandinavian, sometimes for Germans, whether blonde or brunette, sometimes for all who agreed with him politically, including the Japanese. As Hitler used it, the term Aryan had no meaning, racial, linguistic, or otherwise. Jews are people who acknowledge the Jewish religion. They are of all races, even Negro and Mongolian. European Jews are of many different biological types. Physically, they resemble the populations among whom they live. The so-called Jewish type is a Mediterranean type, and no more Jewish than the South Italian. Wherever Jews are persecuted or discriminated against, they cling to their old ways and keep apart from the rest of the population and develop so-called Jewish traits," with quotes around the word Jewish. "But these are not racial or quote-unquote Jewish. they disappear under conditions where assimilation is easy. I'll say a word here about Hitler. I mentioned him previously, and this applies to all of their arguments where they refer to Hitler. I don't know much about what Hitler said or didn't say or what his positions on anything were, other than what I was indoctrinated with at school. So I don't know much about how he used the term Aryan. And perhaps somebody who does know more about it can leave a comment, a link or something to something with more detail. And eventually I'll get around to reading what Hitler actually had to say about Aryan. But at the moment, I don't know. And I don't think it's necessary to know, because I think the arguments that this pamphlet makes where Hitler is concerned are a kind of fallacy. And this is a fallacy that was later called reductio ad Hitlerum. And that's a term coined by a Jew named Leo Strauss in 1951, because the tactic, the argument had become so obvious, so overused, and so obviously false. The argument is basically, or the fallacy, the nature of the fallacy, is the presumption that Hitler is bad, and Hitler said X, and therefore X is bad. Beyond Hitler, they're deliberately obfuscating reality here, and it's a reality which isn't really difficult to explain. Aryan is not simply linguistic, no more than Jew is simply a religion. In both cases, they're actually glossing over differences. You know, they're lying, in effect, by omission. In the case of Aryan, I covered this in previous installments. The Aryans were a people that originated in West Asia and migrated, conquered the peoples around them, and thereby imparted their languages to them, to the east and the west of their original homelands. And we know that from evidence left in the languages and also from cultural artifacts, actual archaeological artifacts that they left behind. And we also know it from DNA evidence that I still haven't gotten to yet. I haven't gotten to the details of DNA at all, but I will eventually. And Jew is not simply a religion. Jewish traits are racial in the sense that they're heritable. They're genetically based. What they're doing here also is they're inverting the cause and effect of Jewish differences, Jewish traits. It's a mutual alienation between Jews and non-Jews. Not this one-sided persecution of Jews for no reason at all. This is typical, though, of the Jewish narrative, of the Jewish version of history. But it's really more of a chicken and egg problem of, and as I say, mutual alienation. But you could say also, it's fair enough to say that the differences arose, the differences between Jews and non-Jews arose and then were maintained by Jews who were discriminating and separating themselves from their host populations. For the most part, refusing to intermarry with the host populations that they were living amongst. And Jews, for the most part, don't assimilate, because if they did, otherwise, they would have long ago ceased to exist, living as they do amongst other people. And the truth of the matter is with Jewish identity, and I have a lot more to say about this, and we'll focus some installments on this in particular, is that the core of Jewry is hostile, utterly hostile to assimilation of Jews to their hosts. In fact, what they do, they lobby politically, they organize and lobby politically to demand special rights and privileges for Jews. And what they're actually doing is causing the host to assimilate to their desires rather than the other way around, to the extent it's possible. And we see that with circumcision, with kosher food, even things like hate laws, and even anti-racism. They impart their way of seeing things onto the host population to make it more comfortable for themselves. And even the supposedly assimilated Jews help with this effort. Jews discriminate themselves from others. They set themselves apart. And religion is only one component of that. The key component of Jewish identity is actually biological, not ideological. There is a component of ideological to it. And part of that is religious or religion. But it's an identity ultimately that's passed from parents to children. And it's passed whether their children want it or not. I think Carolyn had a guest on her show, her Saturday afternoon show a few weeks ago, Harlan Schulke. The show was titled How the Translator Affects Meanings in the Protocols of Zion. And they had, in the first half of the show, a very good discussion about Jewish identity. And Harlan's point was that it's a strange kind of nationality. That's about as close as we can come to understanding it. And until I do something more on it, I think that's a great place to get an understanding that's very close to my understanding of Jewish identity. The pamphlet goes on, Italians are a nationality. Italians are of many different racial strains. The typical South Italian is a Mediterranean, more like the Spaniard or the Greek or the Levantine Jew than a blonde North Italian. The Germans, the Russians, and all other nations of Europe are nations, not races. This is sort of a play on words, and it's I notice here, too, that they actually are using race. They acknowledge the existence of racial strains, and they're just using it to argue that race does not equal nation. It's really an argument by conflation and confusion based on this issue that I've talked about before, this misunderstanding of deliberate in this case of what nation means. Madison Grant argued that the nations, quote unquote, nations of Europe cut across these racial lines, these what they call racial subtypes or racial strains here in this pamphlet. But the classic meaning of nation was basically racial strain. It's the modern use of the word nation that's wrong, really. The alliance or conglomeration of strains into larger, broader groupings, what we call nations, or like Italy, it's still a racial alliance and a racial conglomeration. But it's this use of the word nation as a synonym for country or state, any country, any state, calling it a nation, is what causes the confusion. I'll point out too that this blurring of these distinctions between race and nation and saying they have nothing to do with each other, this denial, it helps to facilitate the creation of empires, these larger conglomerations, larger still than Italy. And by their nature, empires are composites. They're transnational. They're multiracial. So I think that's all I have to say about that. But, you know, why are they using this argument from confusion and conflation? And it's to justify racial mixture, which is the very next section, which is titled Racial Mixture. As far back in time as the scientist can go, he finds proof that animals and men moved about in the world. There were different kinds of animals, and many of them went great distances. But wherever they went, the different kinds could not breed together. A tiger cannot mate with an elephant. Even a fox and a wolf cannot mate with each other. But wherever groups of people have traveled from one place to another and met other people, some of them have married and had children. Well, lions and tigers are capable of breeding. And likewise for wolves and dogs. They forgot to mention those examples. They acted like animals don't interbreed and humans do. And actually, there's some similarity there between animals and man. And in fact, one of the similarities is that left to ourselves, primates, for sure, and even for the most part humans, also demonstrate a similar general aversion to mixing. The Aryan conquerors in India codified this aversion as the caste system, and in the U.S. there were laws against miscegenation. An objective scientist, and a scientist who was really trying to be objective, as these people present themselves, could set aside their anti-racist agenda, or even an agenda in favor of race, and recognize that this capability of mixing and the tendency to discriminate and to compete is perfectly natural, not only amongst animals, but amongst man, too. It's a step towards speciation, ultimately, if the strains of man, the racial strains of man, were separated long enough, they would eventually develop into separate species and lose the ability to even breed together. Racial strains which set aside their racial agenda, though, will be outcompeted by those who don't. And the key understanding here, and the point that I want to make, is that among man, argument and communication are part of what determines fitness and survival, ultimately. And lying and fraud and propaganda and psychological warfare are all part of that. They're all part of the fitness equation. So that's why our enemies try to forbid us the ability to speak to each other. They try to interfere with our ability to speak with each other, and they, at the limit, will try to outlaw it. The same section continues. We are used to thinking of Americans as mixed. All of us have ancestors who came from regions far apart. But we think that the English are English and the French are French. This is true for their nationality, just as we are all Americans, but it is not true for their race. The Germans have claimed to be a pure German race, but no European is a pure anything. A country has a population. It does not have a race. If you go far back enough in the populations of Europe, you are apt to find all kinds of ancestors: Cro-Magnons, Slavs, Mongols, Africans, Celts, Saxons, and Teutons. I like how they mix Africans in the middle of that. Very subtle. What I take away from this is, whites are diverse in the true sense of the word. We've already reviewed the history of Europe and the racial history of Europe. So anyone who's been following my series here understands that diversity. The crime that the Germans committed from a Jewish point of view and from these anthropologists' point of view was actually in declaring and trying to win for themselves Germany for the Germans and excluding from their definition of German Jews and other aliens like Gypsies and Slavs, identifying them as non-Germans. That's what really upset the Jews. It had very little to do with purity, except in the sense that German doesn't mean Jew. In fact, I think, again, I don't know much about what the policies of National Socialist Germany were exactly, but I suspect that purity, as with other racialists, was more of a relative idea. It was more of an ideal to be strived for, and less purity is something to be avoided. And I'll note, coming up to the end here, that this represents a flip in values. And this is what the ideal was for a very long time. And it has been flipped. And this pamphlet was the beginning of the flip. This is how it was accomplished. Today, mixing is the ideal. And purity is frowned upon, something to be avoided. And that's all there is to say about that. I'll have more the next time, also from this pamphlet. We're going to continue probably for a few more installments yet. So please join me then.